Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What up, America? Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is such a pleasure to always have you guys drop into the podcast on Apple, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You know, you do that download thing, you'll find me. Such a pleasure to have you here, particularly this week. History was made this week by Joe Biden in his selection of his vice presidential running mate, and we're going to get into that with someone who understands and appreciates what history is, because she is part of Maryland history and American history, coming from a long-standing political family in the great city of Baltimore. She is the former mayor, the 49th mayor of that wonderful city, Stephanie Rawlings Blake. Secretary of the Democratic National Committee, and was the first African-American woman to hold the post of President of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. She was given the first Citizen Award by the Maryland State Senate, named Maryland's Top 100 Women, and in 2007 and 2011 by the Maryland Daily Record, and she got that particular award, and named Shirley Chisholm Memorial Award Trailblazer by the National Congress of Black Women. Like I said, she's a trailblazer and a history maker herself. Mayor Rawlings Blake, welcome to the podcast.
It is my pleasure to be here with you.
Well, you know, it's great, given everything that's been going on this week and the history that was made. I kind of went back in time a little bit to when I got elected Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, and of course, made a little history there as the first African American elected statewide, and it was hysterical to me how you know, the more partisan Democrats on your team responded to that. But the one response that stood out to me and actually moved me was from your father. Your father reached out to me before I even was inaugurated. And he said to me, "I'd like you to come up to Annapolis, you know, in that little period before the session begins in January." Mm-hmm. Everybody's doing the last minute fundraising. I did a fundraiser for your father, January 3rd, 2003. And I went back and I found my remarks from that, and talking about your dad, who was chairman of the Appropriations Committee. I made these comments. I said, "Chairman Rawlings knows all too well that the task before us is a difficult one, and that it will be a painful one. But it's my strong belief, like his, that elected officials are elected and paid to determine priorities, to make those difficult decisions. And the governor and I intend to do that with him at his side and him by our side." And then I said, "Some may be asking why the Republican Lieutenant Governor-elect is here today to offer support to the Democratic Chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. If the truth be told, Mr. Chairman, most of the people doing the asking are on my side of the aisle, because Republicans lost their friggin' mind. What are you going to do, a fundraiser for Rawlings? Oh, my God." But it was... I know now and understand in watching you as mayor where you got that sense of responsibility for leadership. And you were mayor at a difficult time in Maryland, in Baltimore particularly, when Freddie Gray was killed. And we'll get in that in a moment. But I want to get your mm-hmm. sense in this moment with the elevation of Kamala Harris to the vice presidency by Biden, to potentially become the first African-American woman in that position. What's your sense of it? How do you piece this moment together as you look at it and walk through it?
Yeah, it was a day that it feels like it was, a second ago, and it there's been so many emotions since the announcement. It feels like, years ago,
right.
Because there's been, it's just been so electrifying. I've had goosebumps since the announcement was made. I'm very, very grateful for Joe Biden's leadership. I think he is, he's smart, he's qualified, and he is not afraid to be truthful with the country about the importance of African-American women to the Democratic Party. And I think he made that very clear yesterday. I think for far too long, the Democrats have really chased elusive and really votes that aren't dependable or loyal,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes overlooking the stalwarts of the party. And I think with the nomination of Kamala Harris, I think we're correcting those errors.
Yeah, it seems that way. I think in 50 years, maybe longer, but certainly well into the future, historians are going to look back on this period. And I can't help but believe, and I really think this will be the case, the triggering event for everything we see right now is the murder of George Floyd. Because if you stop and think about the trajectory, and I was on the record at the time before the killing of George Floyd about how Biden was going to process this this selection and who would make the most sense. And Amy Klobuchar, in my view, was probably the best position of all the people that were being talked about. But that changed everything because his murder pushed back on the reflection of her leadership when she was attorney general, right? When she was in the position to do something in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, and wow, all of a sudden completely taken out. And then it began to elevate the conversation and refocus that energy around the role of African Americans in the life, culture, and politics of this country. And it's just, for me, it's been this real amazing transformation. How do we process this? I mean, you're right in that, it's kind of numbing at first. You're kind of, wow, this is actually kind of happening. You're sort of touching it and walking through it. But this is real. It has a real impact because if she is elected, with Biden, yeah, we can do the politics about what that means, but culturally, socially, economically, what do you think it says for African Americans in that moment that we no longer are in the shadows? And you would think that with Barack Obama's election, but we saw that was not necessarily the case. There were a whole lot of stuff that, black folks still didn't get realized during that period. Do you see this now as sort of the either continuation, not the completion, but the continuation of that effort of exposing America to black folks in a way that has been shadowed or overshadowed for 400 years?
I think it's a good opportunity to expose the entire country to the strong leadership and the intelligent leadership and the principled leadership of African-American women. I think you're right. The lens through which America looks at African Americans has changed after the death of the murder that unfortunately we all watched of George Floyd, and with this new lens, I'm optimistic that we will have an opportunity to challenge some really intractable problems. You know, I know that we're not going to solve racism, but I think with a Vice President Harris, we can start to unwind the system of racism. We can have smarter conversations about what policing looks like in our country. And we can focus on the things that are going to help us get out of this this crisis, the multiple crisis that we're in as a result of the president's mishandling of corona. You know, we need leadership in this country right now that wants to take responsible for leading this country, but responsibility for leading right. this country, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but why couldn't we do that with Barack Obama? Why couldn't we have that, make that that exposure more real during the 8 years that you had a black president? What is it about a black woman as vice president that, in your view, seemingly does something that did not happen? And that's really where I was going with my question. With, you know, that seemingly will open up minds and hearts and all this stuff. I mean, that, now it may be, look, you and I know what it's like to be first, right? Mm-hmm. they pile a whole lot of crap on you. He's right. like, no, my bag ain't that big. I'm not carrying all of that. So it may be a matter of, you know, and this will happen. People will push onto her a lot of stuff for her to carry. But I guess, you know, even in light of that, what is it about her election that somehow, because this is the impression I've gotten, it seems like it's different than Obama's, you know, in the sense that the energy seems a little bit different. It's somewhat the same, but it seems a little bit different. I've been trying to put my finger on this the last few days and understanding about that.
It's the difference of the times. You have to remember. Mm-hmm. When Barack Obama was elected, we were in a financial crisis. You know, we were in, you know, there was a lot of distrust in government after the, you know, the botched wars in the Middle East. You know, it was a different time. And I think the alignment of the focus on racial equity and health equity and economic equity in this country, that the alignment of that coupled with someone as dynamic as Senator Kamala Harris being nominated to be vice president, that's what makes it different. You know, I think you're right. You know, the first have, there's a heavy load that the first are expected to carry,
right?
And I think I think a lot of people wanted to use Barack Obama's election as a way to say that now we have a colorblind society. Now, you know, this is proof that, you know, we've conquered racism, and that just wasn't the case,
right?
And I think you know, he spent a lot of time trying to bring our country out of the depths of the recession of the Bush administration, and do a lot of work to put us on the path that you know, we still are benefiting from. But I don't think, you know, because he didn't cure racism, you know, and fix troubled police departments across the country, that it is a knock on President Barack Obama. I think he, you know, when you take a look at the challenges he faced, I think that he and Biden did a Herculean task and did it well.
Yeah, I see your points there, and how that period sort of transformationally, in one sense, it almost de-emphasized the sort of the racial overtones, and I think a lot of that had to do with Obama himself. He was not someone who would, you know, play up is the wrong phrasing, but I'll use it. sort of play up that part of it, you know, to sort of use that as a carrot and stick in his. I mean, he always seemed a little bit hesitant or uncomfortable. This is different. This period is different, and I think, again, going back to the murder of George Floyd, coupled with the economic downturn, the scourge of coronavirus, and then the civil unrest that was born out of that. And that, for me, it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition, because you were in the middle of that fight in Baltimore, and when Freddie Gray was killed and had to manage that as a black female mayor, and to deal with all of the externalities that attend those types of events, didn't have the sort of the national wave that we had with George Floyd, but it certainly had a huge impact on the city of Baltimore. How does an event like that shape not just the leadership, but the discussion around issues like race, having had to confront that, and having a whole lot of white folks look at you suspiciously, which you will get to Governor Hogan's comments at that time, and your pushback on them. How did you sort of manage that? What was your priorities in those moments?
So it's interesting, you know, as I watch now, as the right, the desperate right, starts with their attack on Senator Harris. She's, you know, she's nasty, she's mean,
right.
She's, you know, all of those things, and I see how ridiculously sexist and racist, and so overtly so, the commentary is. It reminds me of that time during, you know, after the death of Freddie Gray and the unrest we had in Baltimore. And, you know, for me, when I take a look, well, you know, as an elected official, when you take that oath, your priority is as a caretaker for the people that you serve, to protect the people that you serve. So for me, it was very, very important for me to make sure that we didn't lose one life.
Right.
As the protesters, you know, that I protected their ability to exercise their First Amendment right and to make sure that no one was killed. As you know, in 68, it was different.
It
was riots looting, and at the hand of the National Guard, I think about 7 people were killed during those riots. And that was on my mind when I was making decisions. And it is interesting to me when you take a look at cities that are still in the midst of unrest with riots, looting that are still going on, that in Baltimore, we had almost exclusively peaceful protests because of the work that we did with community leaders, religious leaders, and things like and other and really with the activists as well, who wanted to put the focus on reforming the police department. And with that, we had, like I said, primarily peaceful protests. That we got the protesters at the end of the big march we had got unruly. We were able to pull that together. As ugly as it was, we were able to gain control in a few hours, had another peaceful day following that. And almost the entire day of the funeral, at the request of the family, we had peace. We had an unfortunate incident where we knew that we were going to have some students, high school students, were going to protest. And unfortunately, the state, Governor Hogan, shut down the transportation hub for those kids to leave. And it and it ballooned into the situation that we now know as the riots, the Freddie Gray, the unrest that it's known. During that time and the time after, so that the during that unrest that night when we eventually called a state of emergency, we had about less than, I would say, I don't want to give an exact hour, but I know it was less than 12 hours. I can say that before. I know it was a lot less than that, but I can't remember the exact number, but less than 12 hours of unrest. And after that time, we put implemented the curfew and didn't have any, hadn't had any, during my administration since. Why did this happen? Because I was very careful in the way that we brought in our resources. So we didn't over-militarize. We used the right appropriate amount of force. We made sure we protected lives. And I'm saying all that to say, one day of unrest and, I'm being labeled by Hogan as, afraid and this and that. When I think when you take a look at how I handled it and how other mayors have handled, subsequent things, I think that there's no comparison. Like, we were able to get things under control, work with the people that we needed to on the ground to bring peace to our city. I think because of racism, because of sexism, because of entitled, people like, people almost in, I don't want to say entitled, but just because of those things, he's trying to paint me as ineffective when I did exactly what I took an oath to do, when that is to protect the citizens of my city.
Yeah, I'm glad you sort of expounded a little bit on that narrative, because I think it's important for people to sort of appreciate and understand the nuances behind some of what you were saying and describing. Because the one thing that I learned in the various roles that I've had, and this was particularly true at the RNC, is that white folks' expectation of black people is always something black people just can't live up to. It just isn't. Right. Because they expect you to think and act and respond the way they do in any given situation. And what I think has been so telling and revealing in the last 10 or so years, probably even more, as more and more black men and women move into these roles like mayors and county executives and governors and lieutenant governors. We have a number of black lieutenant governors around the country, AGs, and now potentially vice president, is that we going to do it the way our experiences have taught us and trained us and prepared us to do it. I was very struck in the sort of heated battles between you and Hogan at that time. You reflected back on that in an interview with Bill Hemmer, and this quote, folks, this is so Stephanie Rawlings Blake. She says, if I gave space in my life to the unbounded criticism of the white men that I've encountered in my life, well, I just don't intend to do that now. And I think that's the freeing part of this, is that you got the job and you did the job. And there's always going to be criticisms for why you did it this way or that way, but you put your mark on it, and you would not be bound by, nor would you allow yourself to be controlled by those criticisms or those opinions of white men in this case, that would sit back and judge what you're doing, and that, oh, you're not meeting this expectation. Oh, you've got to do it this way. You've got to do it that way.
And second guess when they have no track record of doing anything better.
Right. So, there is that.
Right. So,
because you both were in that crisis together at the same time. Right.
At the exact same time. And I get you, when you understand this as well. When you put yourself in public office, you accept all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly. You take the accolades and the criticism. And I didn't mind either. But the challenge I have is criticism that's coming from people who didn't have one suggestion on how to do things differently or better, and no track record of being able, no track record of success. So it's not like he could point to anything and say, well, when this happened to me, this is how I handled it, and it went well. Like, none of that.
Right.
So, I think his criticisms also fell very hollow, because I said to myself when I was, people were asking me about his criticisms, I said, let's just say that all of those things are true. Every single thing. Let me just give you that. That does not take away from the fact that he has woefully ignored Black people in Maryland, as his record reflects, with the disinvestment in transportation, the disinvestment in education. He touts the fact that his education spending has gone up every year. It is by an equation, not by his hand. Every time I think about it, let's say it's true. It still doesn't answer for his record and the things that he's done to show that he does not value African Americans. You can look at his cabinet. You can look at the people that he's brought in, beyond his cabinet. You can look at his criticism of literally every. I haven't heard him say one positive thing about one Black elected official that he has encountered. So I think that his criticism is more a reflection of him and his values than anything that I've done.
We're talking with former mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the ins and outs of this upcoming election. Baby, this is going to be a hot one out there, folks. You know it is. And if y'all don't get off y'all ass and get ready to vote, I'm going to be coming for you. More with the mayor right after this.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Welcome back. We're talking with the former mayor of the great city of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, who serves as secretary of the Democratic National Committee. So, Madam Secretary, I need you to put your
former secretary.
That's right. Former secretary. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the best title one can have is former, that's for sure. that is for sure. You notice how quick she said that, folks, right? No, former secretary.
I enjoyed the post.
How long were you in that job?
4 years.
That's what
and
I thought, yeah.
I was the first African-American to do the roll call of the state.
That's right, I remember that, yeah.
And I think I was the first to gavel in the convention. It was under very strange circumstances.
Right. That was a weird convention.
Yes, but, I relished the opportunity that I had to serve as secretary, because just like with with Senator Harris, I saw what that did to the younger generation of Black women who saw me in that position and saw new possibilities for themselves. So that's why this is for me so deeply moving, this moment that we're in.
So this moment that we're in could potentially reveal the first African-American woman as vice president of the United States. You already alluded to some of the bromides and incoming from my side of the aisle, which I think is, at least this week, has shown a lack of preparation and desperation. Look, it was kind of like Kamala or this. So, folks, you could have come up with something better than you did, but they didn't. And it's just the typical stuff. But it does speak to how potentially ugly this campaign could get. What are your concerns going into November as you look to kick off the Democratic National Convention next week, which will be a virtual event? You've got the president virtually shutting down the U.S. Postal Service. So there are more and more concerns growing out there about the ability for voters to access the ballots through the postal system by, you know, making their request for vote by mail or absentee ballots and the safe return of those ballots to their election headquarters, Board of Elections, rather. What are some of the concerns that you have as a citizen, not so much as a partisan, you know, Democrat and former official and all of that, but just looking at this upcoming election and the significance of it, how are you pushing the narrative for folks to really take this seriously, what could potentially become a huge cluster, you know what, come November?
Yeah, I have a serious concern as an American, as I watch the president try to dismantle our democracy, and there's so much silence from Republicans. And that concerns me because up until now, whether I was naive to believe it or not, I believed that the overarching principles, whether they were adhered to or not, the overarching principles of our dominant political parties were based in the belief of, you know, protecting our democracy and protecting the values that we have as a country. And when I see the president attacking our democracy in such, you know, vulgar ways with what he's doing to the post office, and to see Republican leadership silence, you know, standing on the sidelines, mm-hmm. silence, it is very disappointing to me, because I don't think people realize how fragile our democracy is. We're a relatively young country, and you know, our democracy is not, it's not guaranteed. It is something that we have to work to protect. So, you know, the concern that I have is that the moral reckoning that I think that Republicans need to have about their values as Americans, you know, I think they're not answering the call, and they're failing. They're failing. And that's my mm-hmm. primary concern, because, you know, this is going to be a very dangerous time for our country if Trump is successful in breaking down the dependability of the post office. But what I know is, you know, there are going to be so many people who will do whatever it takes to get him out of office. I don't know if there's a way either that he can, you know, slow the mail or botch his handling of the pandemic that will stop people from coming out to make sure that their votes are cast.
Yeah, it's I cannot stress enough what you just said. I mean, it is so amazing to me how we've gotten here, the way we've gotten here. And it is so annoying to me how members of my own party are sitting back and allowing, particularly with respect to the Postal Service. They know what the truth is about vote by mail. We have, for example, Stephanie, been doing vote by mail in this country since the 1800s. Certainly within the Republican Party is sort of a foundational, operationalized way to get our vote out. Since you know, the 1970s and 80s. I mean, so it's so to watch all of this narrative kind of unfold the way it has, I think is just so dangerous right now. And the challenge, and I know that, you know, Black women have played such an important role for Democrats in their body politic, you know, and that's now made even more clear. And the impact there. But there's still the rest of the electorate that the Democrats are going to have to navigate through. I have a particular concern about white suburban women, and asterisk, folks, there's a reason why Donald Trump is saying what he's saying to white suburban women, by the way. Everybody's like, why is he talking about the suburbs? Hello. So how do we cut through that? I mean, what is the challenge for the Biden-Harris campaign, the Democratic Party, to hold the disparate pieces together while it also tries to carve back some of those bricks that were taken in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, for example, in the last election because of white suburban voters? And I just don't buy this narrative that, well, you know, now that they've had 4 years to look at Trump, you know, they're coming off, you know, they want to vote against him. Well, I looked at the numbers in 2018, and while the Democrats took the House and did very well, I also saw that white suburban voters voted for the Trump candidate or Republicans by almost 49%, even in losing races. That to me says that there's a lot more work that probably has to be going on there to make sure that you make the case to those voters, those center right, center left, independent voters, that they need to do something different in 20.
I agree. I think as a, you know, as a person who's been in and around politics and elections, you know, like I know that, you know, we're fighting along the margins.
Right.
And, you know, Trump is trying to go to that group of voters that he feels that delivered those crucial states for him. And you're right. They are fickle, in the sense that in those areas in 2018, you know, while you had even the you did have some Democratic victories in those areas, but they, you know, sometimes they would vote Democrat on one candidate and Republican on,
exactly,
you know, in another,
exactly,
in another race. So they're not consistent.
Exactly.
It will be important for Biden and Harris to push back against this narrative that the Democratic Party is going too far to the left. And that's why when you talk about the things that concern you, I talk about the post office, which is very important, and the what I see as a lack of principled leadership in the Republican Party, which concerns me. But it also concerns me with the progressives. And I want to make sure that they don't ruin this opportunity for us to elect Biden and Harris. And I think it's yet to be seen the response and reaction from some notable progressives to Harris as the reaction to Harris as Biden's pick for mm-hmm. VP. I mean, I think if they're smart, they know that the ideals that we fight for as a Democratic Party under Biden and Harris are more closely aligned with you know, with their goals than a Trump presidency. And while not perfect, you know, not perfectly aligned, if they don't get closer, if they don't work to get closer, it'll just prolong the time that it takes for them to be, you know, to be successful. And I hope that doesn't happen. That is certainly one of the things that could derail the efforts to identify, to really sway that target suburban vote if Trump is successful in branding us as too far left.
Before I let you get up out of here, you're the former mayor of one of the great cities of this country, which has come under, I think, unfair attacks from folks who've never even walked the streets of the city, let alone spent time there. What would you tell America about Baltimore? you know, their impressions of this city. And I spent a lot of time when I was lieutenant governor walking the streets, walking North Avenues, you know, working with the HBCUs, working in communities, talking to the young men at Eager Street Academy at the time and you know, about their futures and helping them transition out of prison. But then also there is that you know, that entrepreneurial spirit, the old neighborhoods, the families, the communities, and yet everyone sort of looks at Baltimore through the lens of the wire, or they look at Baltimore through the rhetoric of a Trump who says, you know, no human being would live there, which is total bullshit. But okay, that's Trump.
It's a reflection of his racism. It's a reflection that, you know, that in his mind, you know, why would anyone live amongst black people? You know, it's like, you know, and if there were
fair
another option, and that's why, you know, he's making such a point of this rollback of Obama's housing policies that he thinks is going to protect. In his coded language that he's saying to suburban housewives that, you know, don't worry, the black people will not come into your neighborhood if you keep me president. But, you know, what I would say to people about Baltimore is this. Baltimore is an amazing city that is a true reflection of some of the best things about our country and some of the most challenging things about our country.
Mm-hmm.
But in our core, every single person that says that they love our country, love the flag, you know, that we must respect the anthem. If they truly respect the anthem, then the only thing that they should say about Baltimore, or when Baltimore comes up, is thank you, because it is the grit and the resilience of the people of Baltimore, that grit and resilience and, you know, that spirit, that unwavering, undaunting spirit that saved our country during the war of 1812. And, you know, fought back the British when they were, you know, after they had burned down Washington, and they came up the street and thought that they were going to do the same thing in Baltimore. And we fought them back.
Yep.
and led to the end of the war and protected our country. So, you know, people can say what they want. We're rough. We're this, we're that. We made sure that America stayed America. And we have the scars to prove it. So, you know, is racism a problem in Baltimore? Yes. Is poverty a problem in Baltimore? Yes. Health disparities? Yes. Educational disparities? Yes. But we are scrappy and we're undaunted and we're resilient, just like we have always been. And, you know, I think the thing with Baltimoreans, too, is we know who we are. I'm sure you heard this growing up. It's not what people call you. It's what you answer to.
That's right.
And you know, we know who we are. And when ignorant people spew ignorance, it is a reflection. Just like I said before of Hogan, it is a reflection of them, not us.
Spoken like the 49th mayor of Baltimore. She is Stephanie Rawlings Blake. It is such a pleasure having you drop by and share your thoughts on all of it, from Kamala to Baltimore to the requirements of leadership. It was a real pleasure, Stephanie. Thank you so much.
It's great talking to you.
Absolutely. Well, that does it for this round, folks. Looking forward to having you guys back on. Don't forget to do that download thing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn. You know how you do it. Love it when you do. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele, and follow the mayor on Twitter at Mayor SRB. Check out Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake there as well. Till next time, folks, peace out and wear the mask. Don't forget.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.